And it's another week. This is Andrew Wood, Executive Director, Hope Resource Center. So glad that you are joining us today, just a couple days before Thanksgiving. If you want to learn more about Hope Resource Center, you can at investinghope.com. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all of those places. And today we are excited, as we often do, we bring in guests. And today I have a guest on the line who is currently in D.C. His name is Matt Hawkins, and he's the Policy Director for the ERLC, the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission. Matt, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Andrew, for having me. It's a delight to visit with you.
All right, so Matt, as we let's just get into kind of the focus of what we wanted to talk about. So give a sure. sense, kind of give us an overview of who you are, the ERLC, what's going on. I know the ERLC is connected with the Southern Baptist Church, and the work that's being done, and why do we have, why is there an office in D.C.? So kind of walk us through a policy director, what you do, and the importance of that work in Washington.
Sure thing. I'll talk big picture first, and then I'll talk a bit about my role. The Southern Baptist Convention is simply an organization of churches in the United States. We're the second largest religious organization, second in size to Roman Catholics. We're the largest Protestant organization of churches with about 46,000 churches, depending upon which church planting season you've counted the churches at. And we, as the ERLC, the long name is the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission. We serve as basically the moral ethics and public policy entity of the Southern Baptist Convention. So we serve alongside a number of seminaries, a number of our mission boards, all ordered to serve local churches and pastors in their ministry work. The ERLC specifically, we help churches and local churches and pastors help to equip them for moral, ethical, public policy challenges of our day, and try to look down the road a bit to see what's coming down the pike, so that our churches and pastors are well-equipped to address them. And we do that through a number of different initiatives. A lot of them are online with multimedia and podcasts like your own. And we do a number of events across the year, some of which we can talk about. And then, so that's kind of a speaking for and equipping role. Or speaking to role, I should say. Then the other role is speaking on behalf of Southern Baptist churches on issues of consensus, and that includes our Washington, D.C. office representing our views in the Capitol. And so we represent the interests of Southern Baptist churches and anyone else who wants to tag along with us to the three branches of the federal government and to bring that witness to bear at the federal level.
So as Christians listen to this, and just to kind of be completely transparent, I'm part of the ERLC Leadership Council and been Southern Baptist since before I came out of my out of the womb, and it is very important work for me. But kind of give Christians listen to this and say, okay, well, I get that, but is this a political organization? Why should a Christian be concerned? And I know we're going to get into some specific legislative issues here in a little bit, but why should a Christian be concerned and feel the need to be engaged at a state and federal level when it comes to religious liberty and looking at things from an ethical standpoint?
Sure thing. Well, first and foremost, we believe the gospel and the kingdom of Christ is meant for all of life. So that means for our families, that means for our churches, that means for our communities, whether we're considering our own vocations or education or the arts, any sphere of that's in the public space is, we believe, is under the authority ultimately of the kingdom of Christ. And our churches and individual Christians ought to be representing Christ's kingdom in whatever sphere that they find themselves in. And some of that work has to do in the civic sphere, and that has to do at the local level, the state level, and the federal level in the context of American government. We would also say that we have a responsibility as citizens living in a representative democracy that we're part of the governing structure, right? We are not merely citizens under a kingship, but we are, in fact, the way our country is ordered. We have responsibilities to participate in the governance. So it's not just about whether or not we will be persecuted, but it's also about whether we will be persecutors and participate in a public policy order that's that's inappropriate and unethical and perhaps unbiblical at times. So we represent it for those two reasons.
Yeah, and what I love about it, and as a pro-lifer, and we're going to get into some pro-life issues here in a second, but as a pro-lifer, sure. I think it's important that we – I always tell groups, any church that I speak to, any group that I speak to, I always say that the pro-life issue is not a political issue. It is a gospel issue. But the reality is, it's not
right.
It's not just that. It is also there's some politics. There's some legislation that we certainly need to support as pro-lifers. And so we come alongside, and the RLC comes alongside, and kind of gives voice to, at the very least, the Southern Baptist Church, and at a greater level, the local church as a whole, and says, look, these pieces of legislation are line up with our values, line up with our pro-life stance. These do not. We support, you know, right. these. We don't support these. So I think it's important from that standpoint, too, to say that it is a gospel issue first. So the reason the ERLC is a thing is because of the gospel. And everything is driven by the gospel. And then it drives our engagement. It drives our interaction. So that's a great segue to a piece of legislation and that occurred in California and different different bills around different states. Illinois has done something similar. Hawaii, some other states are looking at doing things similar to what California recently did by passing the Reproductive Fact Act, and right. ultimately what it was saying was pregnancy centers, and I talked about this on last week's show, is pregnancy centers all but had to drive people to the abortion clinic in California. With this law,
right.
it specifically targeted Christian organizations, specifically targeted pregnancy centers like Hope Resource Center, where I serve, and said, right. you need to post flyers in your building. You need to refer out to for abortion. You need to tell your patients that you are not a medical clinic. You need to tell your patients that the state of California provides abortions through tax dollars and all of that. And so ultimately, you know, lawyers got involved. NIFLA, which is a great organization we're a part of, got involved. And it's made its way now. We found out last week the Supreme Court is taking up this case at some point. So as we look at that, what have you seen? And what are your thoughts on the case? And do you have a sense of which way the court may go? And what kind of – give us the lay of the land in D.C. Are you hearing anything about this particular case?
Yeah. Well, first of all, Andrew, I want to thank you for your work with Hope Ministries. And I served in Northern Virginia, just outside of D.C. I serve on the board of a pregnancy resource
awesome.
Center. And so I get to see that work not as close up as you do, but – it's really a joy and an honor to be a part of that ministry. And so these are the kind of folks, if you're familiar with the Pregnancy Resource Center, folks who are serving women who are considering abortion. They feel pressures from all different sides. They're tempted to go to an abortion clinic. These are the folks who really are, I mean, the term front lines, quote unquote, is often underused, I think, in our culture, but,
sure.
The pregnancy resource centers, no doubt in my mind are literally on the front lines, is literally saving lives and frankly, bringing the gospel to mothers and families. And California, has this law that requires those pregnancy centers to promote and refer patients to abortion clinics. Can you imagine? It's antithetical. It's ridiculous. And note the name of the law, the Reproductive Fact Act. This is the same pro-abortion industry that refuses to acknowledge that our heartbeat, as early as what, 6 or 7 weeks,
right.
mm-hmm. Represents a living thing. These are the same pro-abortion industry that rejects the idea. The confirmed fact that an unborn child is unique from the moment of conception, unique in DNA from its mother and its father. Let's talk about reproductive facts.
Right.
And we can do that all day long as pro-lifers. You're right. Well, the Supreme Court has decided to take up that case. It'll be interesting. To be honest, the chatter in D.C. is a little light right now on that. It's still a little early. I think we expect the oral arguments to happen sometime in the spring, sometime in the new year. And it's probably a little too early to tell. Sometimes you can kind of read between the lines of the questions of the justices once they hear the case. So frankly, I'm gonna plead agnostic on on which way the court's gonna lean. But it is a big case. It's a big case for the pro-life community. It's a big case for pregnancy resource centers. So now, between now and past the oral arguments, really, was a good time to commit these folks to prayer. Pray that the gospel will be represented. Pray that the facts of life, frankly, will be evident. And then also this gets into, I'm not sure what the argumentations of our the attorneys on our side are going to be, but this seems to me to be a little bit of free speech rights.
It is.
As well, because you have a situation where people who don't believe in abortion or are trying to do everything in their power to attract women to different options don't want to participate in something that is antithetical to their morality, sometimes their faith. And this would have the state power breach their conscience to promote and refer people to abortion clinics.
Well,
and that's unacceptable.
And for those listening and trying to get a grasp of this, you know, I would say, especially for those that are in the state of Tennessee, you know, my home state, you know, I think at times it's easy for us to go, well, man, we have like everybody in Nashville is pro-life. You know, our governor's pro-life. Everybody in the legislature is pro-life. But I would remind you that I worked at the legislature not too long ago in 2008, and at that time, the pro-life party was not the majority party. There was a pro-choice governor. There was a pro-choice House, pro-choice Senate, pro-choice speakers. And so just 2008, so yes, we've seen the pendulum kind of go the other direction here in the state of Tennessee, but that doesn't mean that it could change, you know, in just another 8 years or another 10 years. And so I think it is important that we pray. It is important that we get engaged and call our, you know, call your folks in D.C., be interactive with your representatives to say, look, we know that this has happened in California. We do not want this to happen in our state. What do we need to do to make sure that is the case? And go ahead.
I would mention to Tennessee residents in particular, sometimes even though this is a Supreme Court case and it's a different branch of government, sometimes what will happen is that folks on Capitol Hill, members of Congress, will circulate their own friend of the court brief.
Right.
And they will, as members of Congress, all join a letter, basically, a statement of what they believe the case should be decided and what the implications are for their work as legislatures. So that's an important work. So even though this decision will come down to the Supreme Court, our congressional members in the Senate and in the House are not completely unattached from stuff that happens across the street at the Supreme Court.
Right. And when we come back, what I want to get into is talk a little bit about the adoption tax credit. That was a big deal,
sure.
A big deal in the news the last couple weeks. So we'll be back in a sec to discuss that.
I know I'm on the rise again.
So last week, the pro-life movement, the pro-life world was kind of at a buzz because we saw the adoption tax credit in the new tax plan in D.C. was going to be removed. That was all the talk, and you saw a number of people when that was released, a number of folks on the pro-life side come out and say, whoa, what are we doing? Why are we removing the adoption tax credit that is very pro-life? And why, when we have a majority pro-life House and Senate and you know, and the White House, as far as we know, why would in the world would we pull the adoption tax credit? And then after a lot of voices came out against that, we saw that they have put it back in place. So, Matt, as we continue our discussion, kind of walk the listeners through what that was like in D.C., because I'm sure there was a lot of work on behalf of the ERLC and Southern Baptist and a number of other organizations. I know adoption agencies and organizations came out, the March for Life. Yeah. A lot of people, a lot of conservatives came out and said, look, to people in our own tribe, we cannot do this. So kind of walk us through what that looked like.
Exactly. Well, Andrew, I can tell you it was an eventful week. I've been in D.C. for 7 years. I can tell you I've not seen anything quite like this. We did ultimately get on the right side of this. But you described it very accurately. This was not your typical left-right political conflict that most people expect. This was on the conservative side of the aisle predominantly. This is called, as you say, kind of all within the tribe, so to speak. And I can tell you a little bit about that. You know, most of the things that happen in the policy space, whether it's the legislature, the executive order, Supreme Court, usually you have kind of a heads up about. We kind of know the things that are coming down the pike. We have relationships that kind of inform you and keep you aware of things. We do an annual legislative agenda that we revise every year. It's kind of our best guess moving forward. And sometimes that's accurate. Sometimes it's not completely accurate, but rarely. You have a situation like the adoption tax credit where not only the ERLC, but the entire adoption and pro-life community, as you mentioned, was completely blindsided. The short of it was, on a Thursday morning a couple weeks ago, Chairman Brady, he's chair of the House Ways and Means Committee, and that's where the tax reform plan originated. And as everybody knows at this day and age, tax reform is kind of a big deal. The first time, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for significant tax reform. And regardless of what you think about that, that's political reality on Capitol Hill. Tax reform is a big deal, and the Republicans really want to make that happen. The overall scope, the overall theory, it's not perfect, of course, but the overall theory of the tax reform plan is to make taxes simpler, to get more money back in the taxpayers' pockets and less government. Also, in the process of that, means reducing, they haven't eliminated all of them, but reducing a lot of what we call individual deductions and tax credits. So things when we file our taxes, you can say, well, I spent this much money on education, I spent this much money on health care, I spent this much money, say, on adoption, and that has implications for your tax bill. Well, one of the things that frankly got caught up, in my estimation, caught up as a casualty in that effort was adoption tax credit. And so in an effort to simplify things, a lot of these credits and deductions were simply being eliminated. And in the estimation of the House Ways and Means Committee, not all of them, but some of them, enough of them, the adoption tax credit wasn't performing as well as they thought it should, and so they opted to try initially to eliminate it, along with a number of other deductions and credits. Naturally and rightly, in my view, the adoption community and the pro-life community at large said, wait a minute, what are you doing? And we commenced basically a week's worth of, it took literally from a Thursday morning to a Thursday midday to get this thing turned around. And, I want to mention a lot of folks who were instrumental in that, included ERLC, of course, but many other leaders in the pro-life community, the Focus on the Family, the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, Susan B. Anthony List, Concerned Women for America, March for Life, as you mentioned, Students for Life, adoption and orphan adoption groups like Christian Alliance for Orphans and Butner International. Those are just a short list of ones that I'm aware of off the top of my head that we were in communication with. And we engaged our relationships on Capitol Hill. And as you saw in Tennessee, we engaged the grassroots. Russell Moore did some social media stuff. Jim Daly at Focus on the Family devoted some of their radio broadcast to it. A lot of folks devoted their email, their weekly email news update to it. And constituents called their representatives on Capitol Hill. And frankly, it made a difference. We could not have turned that around without members of Congress, specifically members of the Ways and Means Committee, changing that. Because they heard they're from their constituents. So I'm grateful to you guys, and this was really a team effort. And they recognized that, I think, at the day's end, that as the self-professed party, the self-professed pro-life party, it was going to look really, really awful for them to be the ones to eliminate the adoption tax credit. Most, if not many, of pro-life members of Congress have at some point tried to promote adoption over abortion. Trent Franks is eloquent, saying we often say adoption, not abortion, and yet here you had that same party proposing to eliminate the adoption tax credit,
It was really a tone-deaf moment, and when I saw that reported, I thought, Even on a very basic optic level, like the optics of this, the pro-life party, the ones that say we need to defund Planned Parenthood, the ones that say we need to do all of these things, are going to be the party that gets rid of the adoption tax credit. Even on an optics level, right, that is one of the most tone-deaf decisions that could have been made. And then trying to defend it, which they weren't doing a great job of. And so for me, it was such a refreshing thing to hear, like you said, on that Thursday afternoon, that everybody came to their senses. And what it was also refreshing, right, too, was that in a very, very volatile political environment that we currently have, even within the pro-life party, where we have a lot of people that are kind of, you know, we don't really know where we stand. Some people feel like we're a person without a party now. And is, yep, it was so nice to see a pro-life group of folks come together from different backgrounds, Baptist, you know, or Protestant, Catholic, you know, you name it, young people, old people, all walks, to come together and say, look, this is not a good move. This is not a good look. It doesn't make sense. Right. And so hats off to y'all and the others that stepped up. When we come back from this break, I want to kind of shift a little bit, continue to stay on the pro-life legislation, but look at the Pain Capable Unborn Child Protection Act and walk the listeners through what that is and the significance of the House passing it. And I know that it's been passed in years past, but this year a little, it seems maybe we have, you know, some, we're making some ground, that is in the positive direction for pro-lifers. So be thinking through that, and we'll cover that when we come back, Matt.
Oh, where the road ends, but
and we're back. We're joined today by Matt Hawkins of the ERLC. And before we get into more questions, Matt, I guess the
sure,
the most important question that I want to ask you is, are you listening to Christmas music today or not?
I am most certainly not listening to Christmas music today. It is before Thanksgiving.
Okay, well, I will, in your honor tonight, I will listen to nothing but Christmas music.
I appreciate it.
Yeah, I will do that.
You know, that's struck on an internal inside joke in the ERLC and pits me against Russell Moore and Andrew Walker and friends who like to play Christmas music supposedly all year round. I reject such nonsense.
Yeah, I'm not a year rounder guy, but I am a.
Yeah.
This year I was playing it. I had someone walk in my office at work and say, and this was right before Halloween, and say, is that Christmas music? Yeah, it is. It is. So, I think part of that is because it's always been my favorite part of the year, and for
sure,
some reason in 2017, I just wanted to get to that, to something,
right,
that I really enjoyed.
Understand.
You know, so
I understand entirely. Here's my compromise: if the song actually about the incarnation of our Lord, then it's permissible.
Okay,
but if it's the you know, middle 20th century nostalgic stuff, save it for Friday.
So Hard Candy Christmas by Dolly. No, you're not.
No, yeah,
okay,
yeah,
okay.
No, joy to the world.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay, that makes sense. Well, I can
let it snow doesn't qualify in my book.
Okay, well, you're entitled to be wrong. That's fine. So, so as we shift back to some important work that's being done in Washington, recently the House passed the Pain Capable Unborn Child Protection Act, and I know that's a mouthful, but
yeah,
if you could walk the folks through this legislation, the significance of the House passing. I know Senator Graham is sponsoring it in the Senate. I believe, and what that means. I mean, we've passed it before. Of course, at that time we had a person in the Oval Office that certainly wouldn't have signed it, even if it made it to his desk.
Right.
And so, so what does that mean for the pro-life movement moving forward?
Right. So the Pain Capable Unborn Child Protection Act, as you say, is something of a mouthful. The most recently, when it was passed in the House, they took to calling it Micah's Law. Micah is a young boy who's now 5 years old, who was born at 22 weeks, and they decided to attach a face to that particular piece of legislation, and if Micah could survive at 22 weeks, why not other children? Why
Amen.
Do not? Why does the protection why does the protection of law of their, you know, of their life under law not qualify for children in utero who can feel pain? Surgery done in utero, particularly at 20 weeks or so, often use anesthesia. as a regular practice. And so we recognize that pain is an indicator of certainly something that we ought to not be dismembering children at or chemical burning them. So the Pain Capable Unborn Child Protection Act does just that. It extends the right to life to 20 weeks or basically whenever science shows evidence that there's pain, that the fetus can feel pain. And I want to point out that this law is something what I call fully baked legislative idea or fully baked policy. What do I mean by that? Like you said, it's passed previous houses of Congress. What has to do, what a law has to do to get signed into law from being a bill into law is to make it through the House, through the Senate, all in the same session, the two-year period, and signed by the president. The other thing I like to point out is that something like the Pain Capable Unborn Child Protection Act has passed in at least 20 states. Right, so we mm-hmm. believe in this thing called the United States, and we recognize that the states are often the labs for democracy. 20 states—that's a pretty good success rate for something like this. And all current Republican leadership has either co-sponsored or voted for versions of this bill in previous sessions of Congress. That includes Majority Leader Mitch McConnell in the Senate, Senate Majority Whip John Cornyn, Speaker of the House Paul Ryan, House Majority Whip Steve Scalise, and finally, in a letter to pro-life leaders during the 2016 presidential campaign, President Donald Trump vowed to sign this bill into law if we can get it to his desk. So what does that portend, right? It passed the House, as you mentioned. Senator Graham is sponsoring it in the Senate. I'm going to be honest with you, Andrew. It's going to be a heavy lift in the Senate. To get this over the hurdle, it needs 60 votes. Mm. And as you know, there are not 60 obvious pro-life votes in the Senate right now. So we need all Republicans to vote for it. That gets them to 52. And then the hope really is placed on about 10 possible votes and 8 to 10 possible votes in the Senate on the Democrat side of the aisle. That formulation is pretty simple. Which states did President Trump win,
right,
but who are represented in the Senate by Democrats and who are being reelected in 2018, right? Mm-hmm. That's really the only hope for the Pain-Capable Unborn Child Protection Act is to get those Democrats to vote for that session. That includes senators from Indiana, North Dakota, Ohio, my home state, West Virginia, Wisconsin, Florida, Missouri, Montana, Pennsylvania, and Michigan. That's kind of our only hope to get this voted into law. So there's some hope, but I'm not going to lie to you, Andrew. It's going to be a heavy lift.
Yeah, it's an uphill climb. The interesting thing about the conversation pro-life and abortion for me is it seems as the only ones that ever compromise are the pro-lifers, right? So when right. you have this conversation, what do you hear? Well, what about rape, incest, life of the mother? And typically a lot of pro-lifers say, okay, you're right. I'll bend on that. And sure. But what we never hear is the folks on the other side saying, yeah, I mean, 20 weeks, that makes logical sense. That's a life that deserves protection. So as we end this segment, and we will certainly pray that will become law. But as we end this segment, quickly walk through, and I recently added my signature to a letter on the Conscience Protection Act. Walk us quickly. Sure. We have maybe a minute and a half in this segment. Walk us through yep. What that piece of legislation is, and why it's important, not just for Christians, but really for the every citizen.
Right. Well, there are various pieces of law in the federal statutes that basically draw what I call a lot of scrimmage between the pro-abortion industry and the pro-life groups. One of those is the Hyde Amendment that prohibits federal government right. Funds from being used to fund abortion and health benefits. Here's another law called the Weldon Amendment that protects the rights, supposed to protect the rights of all, the conscience rights of all Americans. But under the previous administration, the Weldon Amendment was not being enforced. And so you have several cases involving medical professionals like my wife. My wife isn't one of these cases, but she's a medical professional.
Sure.
Where Americans were left without a remedy to defend their right not to participate in abortion. And so what you have now is several cases from a number of states where medical providers, usually nurses, have been forced against their will to participate in abortion or face adverse consequences against their career. And so we, along with U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops and kind of a lot of the pro-life groups that you're familiar with and that I mentioned earlier, have been engaging to get this Conscience Protection Act signed into law. It's wrapped up in a complex situation now as kind of an add-on, an amendment to something called the appropriations process. But we're really pushing to get this signed, pass the House and the Senate by the end of the year. That's basically what it is. And we did a big push along with some other folks a couple weeks ago on the Hill. I got to meet a couple of these nurses, and their testimonies, they're still tearing up when they tell you about what they saw in the context of being forced to perform abortions. And that's not something that we as Americans ought to be forcing one another to do. Even if you're pro-choice, you know, that actually does mean being pro-choice and allowing other Americans to decline to participate in the abortion procedure. Russell Moore and Cardinal Dolan had an op-ed in USA Today a couple weeks ago that's very helpful, shows some collaboration between Catholics and Protestants. And so we're taking this very seriously, and this is a little more hopeful, Andrew, as far as a legislative possibility.
Awesome. Well, when we come back, let's shift focus and look at what's going on in January around the March for Life and the Evangelicals for Life conference, which has become one of my favorite conferences of the year.
Looking forward to it.
Yeah, we'll talk about that when we come back. Well, as we finish up today, we've had an amazing conversation on pro-life issues, legislative issues that are occurring in Washington. And Matt, thanks again for taking some time out and joining us today as we have this much needed conversation. Because folks, if you claim to be pro-life and you're consistent in your pro-life stance, it certainly involves a political side. It involves being engaged at a state and local level. It involves being engaged at a federal level. It also involves being engaged at a neighbor level. And so how is our pro-life ethic being consistent from womb to tomb? And as we talk about that, that's what I love about the Evangelicals for Life conference put on by the ERLC is you go there and we cover everything. Your pro-life ethic is last year we talked about racial reconciliation. We talked about being pro-life when it comes to a child in the womb, when it comes to doctor-assisted suicide, all these topics that are so important I think so many people say, yeah, I'm pro-life, but we've never really given a lot of thought to what that means.
Sure.
And that's what I love about the conference. So tell us a little bit about the conference that's coming up in January in conjunction with the March for Life, where hundreds of thousands of people will be going to Washington, D.C. and standing for life.
Well, like you said, it's a really exciting conference. I'm glad that ERLC and we collaborate with our friends at Focus on the Family and a number of other allies to host this annually. And it's really a great conference. I highly recommend it. I know I'm biased a little bit because my own agency is hosting it, and it's in my home city. I want to just invite everybody to come. It's January 18 to 20. Evangelicals.life is the website. That's www.evangelicals.life. It's very easy to remember. And you can learn more about the schedule and the guests and the panelists and the registration and recommended hotels. But come to Washington, D.C. Join with us. The March for Life is the largest pro-life protest march anywhere in the globe. Happens every year in January. Now, it is cold, so wear your scarves, bring your mittens, bring your hot hands. I promise you, it can get cold. Now, some days it's sunny and in the 40s and it's not so bad. Other days, like you're in a snowstorm. So just be prepared.
Yeah, a couple years ago, it was fun. So.
Yeah, a couple years ago, I don't know if you were up there.
I was there.
I forget, but were you there?
I was there.
You were snowed in, weren't you?
Yeah. We had church in a conference room because everybody had to stay over till Sunday. Some people had to stay even longer. I actually drove that particular time, and I didn't fly, and I had my giant SUV parked in the garage.
Right.
And by Sunday, I just called my wife and I said, I can't stay here in this room any longer. I'm just going to drive. And so I went to the valet and I said, I don't want you to drive my vehicle. I want you to walk me to my vehicle and show me where it is, and then I'm leaving. And he said, okay. And so that's what I did. And, and it was it took me a little while, but it was a fun time. And really, folks, if you want to see what it's like, and I'll just be completely frank, I'm going to be speaking on the 18th to a youth rally in conjunction with the March for Life. I'll be speaking to about 2,000 high school and college kids as part of the March for Life. But the great thing about this is, and this is going to be part of what I'm going to say to those young people, is I think you need to come to this march and instead of saying, well, I'll get to it one day, because our hope is we're not doing this march for 40 more years. The hope is that the decisions are made and the proper court decisions are made that abortion becomes a thing of the past, a footnote in history, that it's unthinkable in a civilized society. That's where we want to be. So we're not just protesting to protest. We're not marching to march. We're trying to come together, Protestants, Catholics, secular folks, everybody coming together to say, look, abortion is not okay in one of the greatest countries this earth has ever seen. And currently we're in company with North Korea, we're in company with China in terms of our abortion laws, and that shouldn't sit well with us. And that's what I love about this conference, is it's a chance for people to come together. And it is it's an amazing thing. I think for a long time Catholics were saying, hey, Protestants, where are you at?
Right. Absolutely.
And that's what I love. Yeah. That's what I love about this, is it's a chance for Dr. Moore to stand with Catholics and to give that illustration and that picture of coming together. So briefly, why is that important? If someone's listening to this and they're going, "Well, I'm a Protestant. What does it matter about about that connection there?" Why is that important for us to recognize?
Well, look, we have to recognize from recent history that Catholics really led on the pro-life issue early on. It took a while for Protestants to get engaged. There are a lot of historic reasons for that. But we've eventually come around, and the Catholics say the water's warm, come right in. And so we are trying to stimulate and encourage other evangelicals to participate more highly in the March for Life. March for Life, in and of itself, I have to tell you, if you've not been, it's one of the most energetic, joyful, winsome, young, youthful gatherings that you'll see in our country. It's a really hopeful moment. We march from about the middle or so of the Capitol Mall down, sometimes as far down as the, I guess last year was down, it started at the Washington Monument, and then walks all the way up down the National Mall, all the way up to the Supreme Court. There's a rally at both ends. So I would really encourage people to come. There are all kinds of events, like you mentioned, the students gathering, all kinds of events around the March for Life. And if you're evangelical, our conference, Evangelicals for Life, is going to be a good fit for you. So come hang out with us, do a little sightseeing in D.C. if you've not been before. It's a really great moment. We have a lot of fun.
Yeah, absolutely.
We talked about some important issues that we need to be schooled up in our homes and our communities and our schools. But we also have a great deal of fun. It's a great moments of fellowship. And so come dress warm. But thankfully, our conference is not outside, so it's in the comfort of a hotel.
Yeah, praise God.
Hotel conference room. So wear your boots and mittens, but come hang out with us in January. That's evangelical.life, and you can find out more information. Hang out with Andrew and I in a couple months.
Yeah, it's going to be great. Matt, thank you so much again for joining us today. We'll talk to you soon, man.
Great. Thanks for having me, Andrew. Appreciate it.
All right, thanks. Yeah, so that was Matt Hawkins of the ERLC. What a great opportunity to talk about the pro-life issues that are facing this country. I encourage you to go to the conference in D.C., If not, I'm sure there's a march that's going to occur right here in Knoxville. You can reach out to Tennessee Right to Life folks for that. It's going to be a good time. We always appreciate you listening, and we will talk to you next week.